So it's my pleasure to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Lisa Lowitz. We have been carrying a number of her books, and you can see some of them over here on this table to my right, your left, in addition to her latest two books, which she'll be talking about tonight, Up from the Sea and Here Comes the Sun. She's had a number of books here in the store, Jet Black, Yoga Poems, Other Side River, A Long Rainy Season, also Sacred Sanskrit Words, which I guess we have run out of, but lots of great books that we've carried for many years without having the pleasure of getting to know Lisa.
I've read here before.
You have?
I have.
Oh my God. Yeah. When was it? It must have been that day that I was absent.
Were you?
One of you must have been here.
Jim.
I was here.
Jim was here. Okay. Well,
you
I didn't.
You corrected him.
Then you should have corrected me, but I'm always being corrected, so.
No, he's so very harmonious.
He is.
But just let you go.
Jim is very.
But
Jim will just let me go.
Last year I read The Yoga Heart.
Excellent. I must have been out of town. But, my first time to have you, the pleasure of your company here at Many Rivers Books and Tea. Anyway, you can see that Lisa is widely accomplished in the field of writing. Because these are books not just all of a piece, but they range extraordinarily widely. and that is something that I greatly admire and I'm glad to support. So please join me in welcoming Lisa Lowitz.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I call him Dr. Jim for having me and Dr. Rob, sorry, and Dr. Jim. Dr. Stewart. So tonight's theme was finding home, which is an interest to me because I am an expatriate. I live in Tokyo for the most part, and I'm sort of between worlds a lot, and I was interested to find out how I could be at home in a place where I don't always feel at home. And so one of the ways that I was able to find home was to be in a place that sort of is always in the present, right? Which is the physical body, right? So the body, you know, can't exist in the past. Most of us can't put our bodies into the future yet. Some of us maybe can. But the body always exists in the present moment. And so my journey, I think, as a writer through all of these books, if there is one thing that unites them, it is embodying the present moment through the physical body, and in some way to find an expression of that through words. The two books I was going to talk about tonight are so different. One is an autobiographical journey. It's a memoir about becoming a mother in midlife. It's called Here Comes the Sun, and it's a pun, son, and S-O-N. And it's about I adopted a little boy from an orphanage in Japan about 9 years ago already. And he was 2 years old. And so that's my journey of going through the process of sort of self-healing, becoming a mother, and finding a home through myself, giving him a home, and also finding and making a home through others through opening a yoga studio. And that's another key for me for finding home was creating a home for others, which is, I think, very much in keeping with the Buddhist tradition. And all spiritual traditions do unto others. So when you want a home, what do? You give others a home. And then maybe you'll receive a home in some way. But then what happened was the earthquake of 3/11/11, which was 5 years ago in Japan, almost to this date. And so that sort of changed everything for me. Things that had been sort of an abstraction for me about living in the moment became much more real. And you guys were there?
Yeah.
You were here. Yeah. Okay. So these are my friends from Tokyo who are now living in Healdsburg. Bill and Christine. So I was there, and my husband wanted to stay. I'm married to a Japanese guy, and he said to me at the time, because there was radiation and it was dicey, and there still is radiation. He said to me, I said, "Do you want to leave?" Because a lot of Westerners were leaving, and rightly so. France, actually, the country of France, hired an airplane to take its citizens away, so we're very concerned about radiation. And my husband Shogo said to me, I have to stay, because he had to stay to take care of his elderly father, and he went to make that choice. But if you want to leave and take Utah, I won't stop you. which was a very intense sort of Buddhist thing to say, you know, putting the ball in my core. And I thought, well, I said, let's wait and see what happens. And if I feel like there's any danger, I will. I'll take him and I'll leave, because he's a child and he has his future ahead of us. We're middle-aged and we don't have that much time. But if I feel like his life is in danger, we'll leave. So what I ended up doing was staying, kept my yoga studio open, and created a shelter for other people who really didn't have any family. A lot of my students were there, and I was just telling Albert that I was teaching a class. There was lots of aftershocks, and I was here for Loma Prieta, but that was a 9.0. It was huge. It was much bigger than the Loma Prieta even. And the old building where my yoga studio was in was shaking, and the students, I said, you guys, I think we should leave the building. I think, you know, we're in like a yoga pose or something. And they're like, you know, there's really nowhere to go, you know. And I said, well, I don't know that I want to die here. And they said, I said, you guys okay with that? And they said, very Japanese, they said, we'd rather die together. It's like, holy shit, you know, I've been calling myself their teacher, and they meant it, you know. Can we swear online? I'm sorry on that.
No.
Is it going to get beeped out? And so at that point I realized that even though I did call myself their teacher, they were in fact my teacher, and in fact Japan was my teacher. So what I've done tonight is I had a presentation. I don't normally give these types of presentations, but I have one because of the tsunami, and I was able to go up to the tsunami area and volunteer. So if you guys can come in a little to see this. We don't have a screen because it's a bookstore, and we're still reading actual physical books, which is a good thing. But if you, Robin, maybe you want to see. So,
why don't you sit here and I'll sit over here?
Can you guys come on, you can bring the dogs. You can even come on the ground. Can you see this? If you don't, some of the things you don't need to see, but basically this earthquake struck and I decided to stay, and I hadn't planned on writing a book about the quake or the tsunami at all, because I wasn't in the tsunami zone. I was in Tokyo for the quake, which was real enough, but I didn't feel that I had to write, or actually really the desire to write about the tsunami, not having experienced it directly. So I went up to the earthquake, the tsunami zone up in Tohoku, and I went to volunteer in the temporary housing there. The people were in temporary housing, they'd lost everything. And I met a little boy who was the exact same age as my son. I told myself I wasn't going to cry. And that he had lost his mother. And he, basically, they said to me, don't forget us. I thought, I didn't think that I had the right to write this book, but after I met the people up there, I felt like I didn't have the right not to write the book. Like, I was there, I was a writer, I was experiencing, you know, I had access to these stories, that what am I going to do with my writing in my life if I'm not going to help people and tell stories that can actually change, and maybe some way shine a light on this. These people, there's 300,000 of them still in a shelter, 15,000 people passed away, 3,000 are still missing. So what I did today, this morning, I went to Willowside School, and I gave a talk. And all these kids were, you know, for them it was just a headline, tsunami somewhere in Japan, wherever that is. You know, and we could make it real, and we could start to, you know, become interconnected. It's not just an abstraction. So the earthquake back, so it hit on March 11th. It was a 9.1. It was the largest earthquake ever to strike Japan, which is saying something, because that's a very earthquake-prone country. It was the fifth largest quake in the world ever. It lasted 6 minutes. 6 minutes is an incredibly long time. It's incredibly long time. And what I did today with this class, these kids, I had them sit still for 1 minute, and that was a long time for them. And I said, so multiply that by six and then see how that felt with the earth just exponentially shaking, right? It was a very intense time. There was at least 517 aftershocks, and some of them were as big as 7.2. It struck the Tohoku region, which is about, you know, 150 miles northeast of Tokyo. And this is the coastline, and the tsunami came about 15 minutes after the quake, and it just wiped out all of these towns along the coast. This is the tsunami hitting. It struck inland, came in. Can you see, Albert?
Yeah.
Kind of moving.
So, can I ask a question?
You can, or maybe you can wait until later.
I'll wait.
Do you remember it?
Probably not.
Because I might answer the question. So the earthquake triggered the tsunami, which reached up to 133 feet, which is really tall. It was one of the biggest tsunamis ever recorded. The island, so Japan is made of seven islands, and the island of Honshu, which is the main island where Tokyo is, it moved. The island itself moved 2.4 meters, so it's 8 feet to the east.
Whoa.
And the earth moved on its axis about 10 inches. The earth itself moved on its axis, and I'll never forget, when the earthquake hit, the sky, I can't even describe what it was, but I have it in the book a little bit. The sky opened up and turned like a bright orange. And then it poured rain. It was something like epic and biblical almost. Because the earth was shifting on its axis, and it was like, what's happening? I should be, you know? So this is the wave actually hitting up along the Tohoku coast. So it just came in, and people said it came in like a freight train. I mean, the sound of it just came in like a freight train. And then that, you know, was the town that it hit. This is a picture I took, and I'm not a good photographer. This is a ship that was basically landed on top of a house. Some friends of mine as a journalist went up 2 days after the quake, and, this is some trees, and this is going to be important later. I'll come back to it. But these were trees along the coast in a place called Iwanuma. Which is really weird because my mother just moved to Iwanuma Street in Napa.
Oh,
isn't that weird?
Wow.
I was like, whoa. and I was just up there last week. But JAL, Japan Airlines, used to have a pilot training center up in Napa. And they went under, but the place is still there. My mother just moved there, so it's a little bit weird. But all of these trees lost their leaves, but they remained. They were acting as a sort of a natural seawall up there to break the power of the tsunami. So, wasteland, total wasteland. Here's a film some friends took 2 days after the quake. They're just driving along the coast. He's a journalist. But you can see everything's devastated, but if you can look beyond the hills, everything was fine. So just absolute total destruction. And everyone was wiped out. Everyone, you know, they had thought they could escape because they'd had tsunamis before, but they'd never had a wave that was 140 feet. So the tsunami was usually like 12 feet, or, you know, you could escape it, right? So, and in these towns, and in the book I have, because it's based on things that I saw, there were stone markers that were like a century old that said, don't build below this, but people ignored them, or they got overgrown. They didn't think it would really happen. So I went to a town called Kesanuma, which is along the coast, and you can see everything was wiped out here, and then there was some foliage that remained up above in the hills. And I decided to write a book based on this kid that I met, and I decided to write it in verse about a Japanese, half Japanese, half American boy who's caught in the tsunami, who loses his mother, actually loses his whole family, based on this kid that I met. And I decided to make him half American because, to be honest, my publisher thought that I didn't have a publisher at that time, but people that I knew in publishing said, American kid's not going to be that interested, something that happens over there, but if you make him half American, there's some connection to America, they'll see themselves in the kid and maybe they'll be more interested to read. So my town, didn't love it, didn't hate it, it was just where I lived. In the back of my mind, there was always New York, where Dad lived a life I could only imagine, far from this sleepy town with its ponds and pines, temples and tea, wooden houses falling into each other like sailors wobbly from too much sake. Days as predictable as the tides. In the back of my mind, I'd graduate from high school and leave the place Dad left behind. So his father's American and he's left the family. And I decided to write this novel in verse because I'm a poet, I write poetry, but also because verse novels are getting really popular with young adults now. And one reason is because they're always doing this, right? And they have short attention spans, they don't like to read as much. There's a lot of white on the page, so it's not as maybe intimidating to young readers. But the main reason is because of all these aftershocks. So if you write a novel, I've only written one before, and even a memoir, it's like a marathon. When you sit down, you've got to really focus and be able to stay focused. And there were so many aftershocks. And huge, like 7.2 big ones were, and when an earthquake hits, you don't know if it's going to be small or big. You don't. And so you run under the desk or run out of your house, or you can't just, okay, well, it's just another, you know, you do that for a while, but then if it keeps going and if it's big, you have to stop. So I was able to force myself to write, I could focus enough to write verse. And then there was 1,000 aftershocks that year. They were happening pretty often, right? So I could focus enough to get something on the page, and then an aftershock would hit, and then I'd get out of Dodge, you know. So the town I visited, they make their living through the ocean. And does anybody know what you do with a boat in a tsunami? Anybody know?
God.
Right, you try to beat the wave. So these boats were on the harbor, and you saw that photo before of the waves coming in. They wiped out everything. So these boats were not wiped out, and the reason is because the fishermen get in them, and if they time it well enough, they beat the wave. So what happens when an earthquake hits, it dislodges the ocean floor, and it pulls back, and then it just roars onto the land. So if they timed it enough after the earthquake hit, before it pulls back, they could go out. And that's what they tried to do, but a lot of them, most of them made it, but a lot of them didn't because they'd never had one of this magnitude. But this is, you know, they don't have a lot of money in these fishing villages. A lot of the young kids move to the cities to get jobs. And so to save their boats for the future generations, they try to beat the wave. So in my novel, that's what, I don't want to have a plot spoiler, but that's what the grandfather does. He gets in the boat and tries to beat the wave. March 11th. Mom rode her bike to the oyster farm, pulled shell clusters from the ocean, pried the oysters from the mother shells, washed the sludge away. Oji-chan, which means grandpa, fixed a busted light on his Sanma boat. And Sanma is a kind of mackerel that area's famous for. Oba-chan picked wild ferns on the mountain. Shin's dad washed his taxi in their garage and bleached the seat covers white as bone. She and Ryu and I walked to school together. Ryu was juggling his soccer ball the whole way home. We planned to skateboard by the seawall after school, but we never made it. So I tried to really get into the experience of what it must have been like to be in that moment. Just an ordinary day, right? Like most of us, we just have an ordinary day and something might happen that we never would have expected. When I went up there, what was really important was the sea life, right? They, in some regions, they farm, you know, rice or tea, but in the coastal towns, it's all about oysters. Miyagi oysters are really well known. you probably can get them here in Napa. And so I wanted to use the image of an oyster as well because, of course, oysters that you cultivate for eating are different than oysters cultivated for pearls, but I was interested in the metaphor of how a pearl is made. Because a pearl is made, anybody know? Well, dirt has to get in. Dirt has to get in, or a foreign substance has to get in, and then it's, covered over, coated to make the pearl. So there's always this idea of somehow, even though dirt happens in my and tragedy happens and difficulty happens, that there can also be beauty out of that. So this is sort of a theme in this novel, and I think in Buddhist life, in the spiritual life, suffering is part of life, and we transcend the suffering and include the suffering in life, and that's the beauty of life. So they see the ocean as a giver of life, right? It is. It gives them bounty, gives them food, it gives them sustenance and livelihood. And so the tsunami, being a taker of life, was tempered by the fact that they have a great respect for the ocean, which gives them so much as a community. These are just random photos I took when I went up there. I went to the temporary housing. As I said, there's 300,000 people still in temporary housing, which is really a shame, and it's a shame on the government of Japan, who I don't even want to get into that, but the people, and it was similar to Katrina, I think a lot of the people were just not taken care of to the extent that they should have been. But when I went up, I do yoga, and I also do massage. And so I went up with my friends Takuma and Iku. He's a BMX champion and a really cool guy. And just got in the car and went up and arranged to go up and do massage and do the temporary shelters. And there was like a 95-year-old woman who walked about 2 miles to come down. And I was a bit worried, like, are they going to allow me, a foreigner? I was the only foreigner they'd probably ever seen. Not only to be there, but to touch them and be, you know, quite intimate. And they were just so grateful. And so it was, I think they gave me more than I gave them. I'm pretty sure of that. So we were up there. And it was beautiful sunset. It was like nothing ever happened, which to me was very striking. Like they'd have this enormous devastation, and then the next day the sunset, and the next day the sun rose. So to me, the sun up from the sea is the sun coming up. There's always a new day. There's always hope, right? Sun rises up over the ocean. So I had a friend make me a map of Kai. Kai means ocean. It's not the most original name, maybe. But the kanji is made with ocean, and ocean, which is made with mother, which is such a beautiful word. So if you read the book, they escape to the bridge, but the bridge collapsed. Which all this was based on true stories. And then they ran up to the hill. And in the book, Kai is devastated by the tsunami and he loses pretty much everything, but he comes to appreciate his town by helping others and to the people that he is helped by. So just an ordinary spring morning, ordinary fight with Mom. Maybe she spoke to me in English and I answered in Japanese, which is based on my real life. Maybe I don't even remember now. Maybe I threw my dirty socks onto the floor or left the toilet seat up again. Whatever it was seemed so stupid at 2:46 p.m. when I'm sitting in math waiting for the bell to ring and the earth starts to shake. I do what they taught us since kindergarten, bring my knees to my chest, cover my head. The desks rattle, the window frames buckle, the building creaks from side to side. My friends and I get up, ready to sprint for the door, but no one runs out. So Ryu starts to dance in time with the shaking, his jagged black bangs swinging across his forehead like a banana leaf broom. Shin joins in, limbs jiggling like tofu. I pretend to be a samurai, whoosh, swipe an imaginary sword through the air to battle the earth. We laugh, thinking we'll get out of school early, thinking the quake will stop like the others always had. But the shaking continues, stronger and stronger, not caring at all what we thought. So I was reading this last week. I went to a bunch of schools in Tokyo, and a lot of the kids were 7 or 8, 9 at the time, and now they're, you know, 12 or even older, and they were saying, that's exactly what we did, that's exactly what we thought. And it was actually very healing because it's been 5 years, and at that time, it was very traumatic. Even though we were not in the tsunami, and Tokyo was actually, you know, knock on wood, this time it was okay. The kids, they couldn't talk about their feelings or experiences. So for them, you know, hearing this book and having me talk to them about it, we were able to converse. And afterwards, I had questions and answers, and one kid raised his hand. And he asked me a question, and he said, and it's a great question no one's ever asked me in all these years of writing or reading. I called him, and he said, how did you feel when you were writing this book? I said, what a great question. And I said, I was pretty much in tears, like I was crying every day that I wrote this book, because I was trying to feel what they felt and be empathetic and, you know, trying to do them justice in writing this book as well. And then when I left, I gave this presentation, he gave me the thumbs up. You know, he was a very sweet kid. And then the teacher came up to me afterward, and she was in tears. And she said, you know that boy who asked you the question? And I said, yeah. And she said, he has a learning difference. I think he was autistic. She said, he's never said anything. Mm-hmm. Ever. And I was like, wow. Because to me, he was so present in that moment. So I felt like if that was the only thing that came out of me writing this book, it was enough. You know, you never really know. You write a book, you put it out into the world, it has its own life. Kind of like a kid, I guess. So that was really a beautiful moment. And one thing I wanted to do in writing this book was to put in things that I saw as I drove up the coast and as I experienced it, this is sort of a historical novel because it's something that really happened. And I wanted to not just tell a sad story, but stories of hope. And so one thing I saw was there was a lone pine tree that survived. It became like a symbol of hope in a way. And there were 70,000 trees along the coast, but only one survived. So that's it. It barely survived. And in the book, I have Kai climbing up a tree and to escape the wave, and somehow he does, which happened in the Indonesia tsunami. So, and when I was writing this book, I went to New York, and it happened to be the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And I learned, and I didn't know this, there was a pear tree that survived the 9/11 attacks. Did you guys know this? I had no idea. But in doing my research, I learned that there was a pear tree that somehow survived down there. And it also became a symbol of hope. And so I decided to, or I don't know if I decided, but the universe gave me this wonderful coincidence. And it, because in Japan, 3/11 is sort of like 9/11 is here. It's a big change that happened to the whole society, and nothing will ever be the same in Japan. And so the way that 9/11, even though it was not a natural disaster, impacted America, 3/11 impacted Japan and still is impacting Japan in many, many ways. So these trees were kind of a symbol of hope. There was also origami cranes. Does anybody know what the crane symbolizes here? It's a symbol of peace and hope. And so there was origami cranes, there was a giant ship, and there was a building where a girl stood on top warning people of a tsunami coming in, even though she was killed. She stayed on top to warn people. So I went and saw all those things, and I put them in the book. And that was the building where she stood. It was completely wiped out. And she could have tried to escape, but she decided to stay and warn people. So the other thing I found out as I was writing this novel, because one of his friends is a soccer player. He was actually a soccer player doing the juggling. But when his father left, he gave up on his dream. And then when the tsunami hit, he decided that he, I don't want to, spoiler, but he would do soccer again to try to rally his town and build a soccer team. And then I heard that this had been done along the coast. And the other thing I heard is the soccer ball, and I tell this story in Japan, a lot of people have not heard this story, so I wonder why it came into my awareness, but a lot of the debris from the tsunami washed up in the States, right? Still washing up. And there was a soccer ball that washed up in a beach in Alaska. Wow, that's pretty remote, right? And a Japanese woman just happened to be walking along the beach. Now, what are the chances of this, right? In this remote part of Alaska, this Japanese woman, her name is Yumi Baxter. She's married to an American guy. So she was walking along the beach, and she's found this ball, and it has some names on it, Yuki, Akira, and Shunsuke. So she realized it came from Japan, and it must have come from the tsunami. And so she cared enough, this is my point, to try to find out whose ball it was and actually return it. So she found this boy who lived in a little town, Rikuzen Takata, was completely wiped out, and she returned it back to him. So I put this in the novel too, and if you've read Ruth Ozeki's book, A Tale for the Time Being.
Highly recommended.
One of the themes in her book and also my book is, you know, what comes back. Like, we lose a lot in life, but things also return to us, sometimes in a different way. So this ball comes back to him, and he sees it as a symbol. So I was very happy to find these true stories of hope to kind of put in the book. And the good thing about writing a book, one of the great things about writing a book too, is that you can put your friends in it. there's a rabbi in my neighborhood, the Chabad House rabbi, and he came to Japan about 15 years ago, not speaking a word of Japanese, as a newlywed with his wife, no kids. And they were wandering around looking for somebody to help them. And they were trying to get an apartment. And, you know, I don't think there were any Orthodox Jews in Tokyo at that time. He's got a big hat, a big coat, and people kind of scared of the guy, right? And finally this one man helped him. And helped him get an apartment. The guy's name is Muto-san. And now the rabbi has 11 kids. 11 kids, he's a busy guy. he runs, you know, he's doing a lot of stuff in Japan. He happens to be my neighbor, and so I see him a lot. And when the tsunami hit, he got in his car and drove up to the tsunami zone. He just got in his car and drove to the tsunami zone, even though it was very dangerous and nobody was allowed in there. And they told him there was cops, and they said, "I'm sorry, sir, you cannot go in there." And he said, no, I have to go in. And they said, "I'm sorry, sir, you cannot go in." And he said, no, I need to go in. And finally they just said, there's dead people here, you cannot go in. He said, "I know, I have to bless them." So he was amazing. So the reason is, he went up there because the guy who helped him, Muta-san, he was from there. So he decided to give something back. He corralled, there's something called that imo, yaki imo, like sweet potato, what do they call, baked potatoes. They're like trucks that drive around with, what do you call it, like an oven, like a komodo, like a, I don't know, what do you call it?
Like a charcoal.
A what? Charcoal, you know, roasting these sweet potatoes. And he just found this guy in the street, and he got to come up to Tohoku with me because these people haven't had a hot meal. And the guy went up, and the people were so happy to see him and have this hot meal. But when they first came, they called him Akuma. And Akuma in Japanese means like devil. They were like, they ran away. They didn't know, what's this guy with the big hat? They were really scared of him. And then he just kept going up there and helping out. And he just received an award from the mayor like last month. So years he's been going up because he wanted to give back. Gambare Higashi Nihon, which means hang in there, East Japan. And some little bit about verse novels. They're as old as Homer, the Odyssey, 8th century, Canterbury Tales. And verse novels are often about a journey or a quest. And so then in some ways, this novel for me was very much a quest, Kai's quest to find home and to make a home, even though his home had been destroyed. They're really popular for young adults because the reasons I said, the short verse, it's good for the iPhone generation, sadly enough. And they often can tap into raw emotion. And this novel was, you know, if you read it, it starts off with the tsunami. It's a very powerful start. So it's a very emotional book. And they can introduce kids to poetry, kids who might be what we call verse-averse. Lots of kids today. I asked in the school, I said, "Anybody here hate poetry?" A lot of hands went up. And I had a kid whose mom emailed me and said she was really happy because her child was dyslexic and can't read books and doesn't like books, but picked up this book and got sucked into it and actually finished it, and then said she was so happy and got confidence because she'd never finished a book before. So the fact that there is all this white space and it is sort of easy to read and does hopefully suck you in is a good thing, I think. So there's a saying in Tibetan from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, tragedy should be utilized as a source of strength. No matter what sort of difficulties, how painful experience is, if we lose our hope, that's our real disaster. So I wanted to put this in there because His Holiness has been coming to Japan a lot after the disaster. He never came so much before, but he's been coming a lot now, and he's been giving empowerments, and I was very fortunate to receive two empowerments from him directly, which is huge. He's been going to a small group of priests, and I was able to be there, and his point was, you know, this, we have to learn from these disasters that happen, and we have to come together as a world, especially in times of disaster. So what we did with some money my yoga studio raised, we helped to build a library. And this was really important for me, particularly because I love to read and I love books, and these kids had lost everything. So Oshika is one of the towns that was hit, and that's the community actually built it, and now these are the kids having a warm place to read, and there's a garden, and 5 years later I was able to go back. I just went up a few 2 weeks ago, and I went to Iwanuma. Do you remember those trees in the beginning that were all without the branches and the leaves? Now they're all back. And my friend Takahashi-san, whose family owns a shrine in Rikuzen Takata, remember the boy with the soccer ball? It's from that area. It was completely wiped out. he started this project called the Great Forest Wall, and it's basically to plant trees along the coastline to act as a barrier, because it will happen again. And if there's, remember, well, here, I'll show you. So see this house here? This was the waves coming in. This is a, I don't know, a, like half a mile inland the waves came in, and there's these trees here. And then that's the house there. You see? So this is it. It's a sort of a close-up with the waves being totally inundated. That's the house. And so they want to build the forest here to block in the next generation. And so that's him. He's a priest. He doesn't look like it because he's wearing a suit. I'm not quite sure why he was wearing a suit that day. We were going to meet with some of the people in temporary housing. And one of the men we met said that he was washed away in the wave. And he blacked out. And then he landed face up, and he had lost everybody. And he didn't know why he survived, but he decided it was to help people. So we were meeting with him and asking him how we can help. He's planting 20,000 trees up there. I love this quote. We don't inherit the earth from our grandparents, we borrow it from our grandchildren. So we've got this project to plant trees. So any profits that I get from it from the sea will help to build this forest. And it's really beautiful because the elder people are building it with the younger people. They're planting these trees. And so I'm just going to end with this. This is an amazing picture, I think, of a monk. Just like, you have to humble yourself to the enormous power of nature, right? What else can you do? Just say a prayer and bow. So, there's a phrase in Japanese, keizoku wa chikaranari, which says perseverance becomes its own kind of strength. Chikaranari becomes strength, basically. So, this was, I think, for me in my life, and also for Kai, the character, and for the people up there, for them, this is very much an embodiment of their ethic in a way. Just persevere, and that becomes enough. You know, that's a strength in itself. So, thank you. That was my talk about this book. Yeah, I know it's kind of an intense subject, but I really felt like I wanted to write about it after I went up there and experienced what I experienced there, and that I was in a position to share that experience and that information in a way that maybe could help. So I think that may be enough. I'm not sure if I need to read from the other book at this point. Maybe we could do that on the radio tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah?
Well, let's hear something about Here Comes the Sun.
You do want to hear about Here Comes the Sun?
Yeah.
I could read a piece. How much time would we go till?
Oh, we have 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Even.
Okay, I'll read. Oh, should I read a part of it?
Sure.
All right. I don't think this isn't 20 minutes, but okay. So Here Comes the Sun again was a book that is very I think more personal than Up from the Sea in a way. This was published in Shambhala Sun in May 2010, and I hadn't intended to write a book, actually. When I wrote this, the editor asked me to write something. So I was in touch with him about a translation I was doing from the camps, from the Japanese internment camps here. And then when I wrote this piece, I got such a good response from it, I decided to write a book, which was a little bit difficult because my family was problematic. But perseverance becomes its own kind of strength. So, I'm standing on a cliff 50 feet above the Pacific Ocean, balanced on a precipice between two oceans. I don't know how life has brought me to this place, this beautiful rock on the Izu Peninsula in the island of Honshu, Japan. But I'm here with my husband and dog. We've hiked up 20 miles to stand on this small point of rock on the Dogashima coast, watching the waves crest below and the falcons crest above. It's my birthday, the dawn of a new year. I sit down on this solid land that cuts into the cliff and give thanks to all who held my hand to pull me up the mountain of life. I feel safe, yet I'm literally perched on a narrow, dangerous place on a cliff that drops straight down to the ocean. But it's not the literal I'm interested in. Deep in my heart, I feel a sense of security and peace I've never felt before. So I shift my weight to one foot. I should do it. I lift the other foot up place it on my thigh, and look straight ahead and hold my focus. If I look down, I'll be overcome with fear. So I'm doing tree pose. I hold my tree pose, breathing deeply. Strength and courage flood my soul. I repeat my mantra. I am calm, I am poised. At the center of life's storm, I stand serene. It's taken me 44 years to get here. I've searched half the world for this feeling, and I know, of course, that it is fleeting. I don't have a Zen master, a guru, or even really a religion. But neither did Tu Fu, Basho, Miyamoto Musashi, and countless other poets and wanderers who made their way through hills and valleys, over mountains and rivers to seek solace. They didn't have to sit in a meditation hall and stare at a wall to look inside. They just looked around and paid attention to what was near them. Their teachers were the mountains, the rivers, the rocks, and the trees. Their parents were Mother Earth, Father Sky. Then they woke up, or should I say, were awakened. I'm waiting for my epiphany. I found 10,000 other ways to be a mother, but I'm still looking for my child. I have a friend who took his 3-year-old boy up to the mountains in the Japanese countryside. The boy ran ahead excitedly, as little boys will do. This is an elegy. There was a wooden footbridge. It hung over a steep ravine 100 feet deep. The boy ran ahead on the footbridge. The footbridge was made of planks of old wood. Not many people walked in the mountains anymore on the old bridge. There were gaps in the planks, big gaps. The father watched. Every year on the date the boy died, my friend posts a memorial picture of his son on his blog. The boy playing a drum set, standing in front of a samurai helmet, smiling for the camera, making the peace sign with both hands. No words, no commentary, only his son's picture and the word elegy. To remember, to honor. Life is not safe. I know that. Nothing is certain. Things we hope for, dream about, come or don't come, and then are gone. I meet with my friend often. In our own ways, we both mourn the children we do not have. Somehow, we have been drawn together in this strange world to mirror each other's pain, to give each other comfort and hope. We will move on, our mutual presence seems to say. We give each other that. Heartlines. My husband is Chonan. In Japan, this is a serious business. Chonan means the oldest son and heir to the family name or whatever fortune the family has acquired. While we'd been away in the paradise of Northern California for 10 years, his younger sister had been doing the dad's cooking and laundry. But his sister, now in her 30s, wanted to start her own life. She wanted to open her own business, to move on. And we couldn't ask her to take care of the dad forever. It was Shogo's turn. It was our turn. I hadn't wanted to go back to Tokyo, the busy life, the pollution, the stress. But I loved my husband, and I wanted to be with him. And I knew that a good marriage was based on compromise, even sacrifice. After all, the root of the word sacrifice is sacred. In the highest sense, to sacrifice is to do something completely for somebody else, with no personal gain. As an independent American woman, that idea took some getting used to. But it was time to start a family. I'd gone about trying to have a child the way I'd gone about everything else in my life. One part perseverance, one part trusting the process. I thought, as many do, that if it's meant to be, it would be. I had a full fantastic life and no regrets. But after 8 years, I did something I'd never done before. I got down on my knees and I prayed. And then my beloved Aunt Peggy got cancer. Her one regret was that she did not have children. She worked all her life in child protective services and had wanted to adopt. She urged me forward with the force and conviction that only impending death can render. I learned of an Australian psychologist who adopted an infant in Japan. She gives me the name of the government agency, Jido Sodenjo. The application asks questions like, why do you want a child? What kind of upbringing and education would you give a child? What are the most important values you would share with your child? What about religion? Filling out the application is challenging, but it's an opportunity for Shogo and me to become very clear on what our values are. So we send in our application and weight. Bloodlines. Everyone says Japan is a difficult country to adopt from. Not only are there fewer children up for adoption, but it's the only country in the world where you need to get the extended family's approval for the process. Bloodlines are seen as all important. One's ancestors are one's link to the past. The family registry, or koseki, goes back centuries. It lists each birth and marriage, tying family to family. When we got married, I did not take Shogo's name, last name, and this caused a commotion at the ward office when the clerk said there was no official space to put my own name on the form. My husband stood his ground. "Well, make a space," he said, knowing this was impossible. If there's one thing about bureaucracy in any country, it is that it most definitely cannot make a space. It would have been much easier for him to request or even insist that I change and take his name, but he didn't. He just waited for the bureaucrat to find a way to remedy the situation. I kept my own name and was added to the koseki. I knew I'd married the right guy. But now doubts start to flood my mind. If we succeed in adoption, I'll be bucking the system again. I know how difficult it is to raise a child, let alone one who is adopted, in a country that's not particularly open to adoption. In Japan, most adoptions are kept secret. Some children don't even find out until their parents die. So we brace ourselves and ask my husband's father for permission. I find out to my surprise that his own father was adopted. Samurai on one side, gangster on the other. My husband has them all in his ancestry. Geisha, gangster, samurai, rickshaw driver. This assortment of characters pleases me. It makes me feel less strange for my difference. My father-in-law says yes. We decide that we're already a rainbow family, Shogo with his long hair and stay-at-home job, and me with my funky yoga studio. Not to mention his family's eccentric lineage and our strange rescued pit bull mix, which we brought from California to Tokyo. In a conservative neighborhood in a conservative country, we already stand out as freaks. Why not embrace it completely? Perpetual yes. The agency calls about a little girl. We say yes. Nothing happens. Months later, they call about a boy. We wait. They offer the child to another family. Many young couples are waiting to adopt, and we are low on the priority list due to our ages. So I'm 44, and Shogo at that time is 48. The chances are very slim, if not impossible. I have to do something proactive. I am fiercely committed to living my dreams. If I'm not, who else will be? Finally, I make Shogo call the orphanage. I insist that he tell him to stop calling us every month to ask if we're interested in a different child. Tell them we're interested, I say. Tell them to put a perpetual yes stamp on our file, okay? Whatever child is available for placement, we are interested. Whatever child, he says? Yes, whatever child. But I can't do that. It's Japan. Everything has a system. Everything has a way. But he's been married to me for long enough to know this is the path of least resistance, and so he does it. And somehow, miraculously, it works. And the little boy they called us about a few months ago is available again. Yes, we say, eager to meet the child who is destined to be ours. But when they come to our house, the social workers come to our house to tell us about the child, the information is sketchy at best. You have a picture? I ask. Nope, no picture. This astounds me. Japan is the land of the camera. How could they not have a picture? Are you interested or not? They ask. They're not messing around with this child. He's suffered enough. So Shogo looks at me and reminds me that you said, whatever child. So for the second time in my life, I pray. We're interested, I say. We visit our child in the orphanage for hours, days, and weeks. Finally, we can bring him home for an overnight. And finally, we can bring him home forever, just after his second birthday. We go to a playground where he can see the bullet trains passing overhead. At the playground, he comes up to the other kids and wants to play with their toys or ball or play with them in general. He wants contact and closeness. He grew up in an orphanage where everything was communal. He has no concept of personal ownership or boundaries. He is the opposite of other kids who have to learn how to share things. He brings his own toys to share, but the other kids don't take much interest in them. I don't want to try to make sense of things like this or explain them to him. He'll learn. I want to cut a path in this crazy forest of life with him. Sitting Zen, walking Zen, playing Zen, mothering Zen. It's all practice, and we have a lifetime together. But my Aunt Peggy doesn't. I want him to meet her before she passes away. So we bring him to San Francisco. He loves his 7-year-old cousin, Shaviv. He's right over there. But he cannot pronounce sh, so he calls him Habib. My sister, who's right here, tells me Habib means friend in Hebrew. We see a homeless man with a cat on the street in front of Macy's on Union Square. The cat has been hit by a car, and the man needs money for its hospital bills. Everyone rushes by the man and the cat, but Yuta pulls on my arm, insists on petting the cat. Then he sits down on the pavement and tries to pick up the cat to hug it. I tell him no, the cat is hurt and he shouldn't touch it, so he pets it instead. Now people stop to look at the little boy sitting on the sidewalk, blocking their path. Some mothers pull their children away. A photographer stops to take a picture. People put money in the basket. More children come to sit by his side. Somehow he brings together the splintered worlds of strangers. He is a healer of cats and hearts, a small wonder in this world of so many wonders. If I ever felt any doubts, I do not know. All that divided us will merge. Though there are many customs for birth in Japan, the mother returning to her parents' home, a celebration of the child's first solid foods, we've missed them all. In California, we hold the Jewish baby naming ceremony for Yuto in Napa Valley. Many people from my mother's community gather to welcome him, though we are strangers. Yuto is given the name Benjamin after his maternal grandfather, who came from Lutz, Poland, and Walter Benjamin, the Jewish writer-philosopher and member of the resistance in World War II. There is a ceremony where we throw all our sins into the Napa River. Any time between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in the Jewish tradition, it's customary to throw breadcrumbs into a body of water as a symbolic act of repentance. It's called Tashlik, ascending out. We gather at the waterfront to cast away the sins of the past and resolve to have a better year in the future. My mother's friends come. Some tell me their stories of how they too were adopted, or how they adopted children, and what a wonderful mitzvah, good deed it is. But I feel it is Yuto's mitzvah to us. My mother ordered a cake for Yuto decorated with Pokemon, though Yuto seems to be the only one there who does not know who Pokemon is. He devours the cake, which says, Mazel Tov, Yuto. Welcome to the tribe. So that's a sort of excerpt from the book Here Comes the Sun, which is about that process of coming to motherhood. Thank you for asking me to read that. So can I take questions? Albert, do you remember your question? I should have taken it when I had the chance, huh? Does anybody have any questions?
Oh, I was going to ask you about the experience of the earthquake in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Like the physical experience in the city.
Yeah, well, as I said, I was here for Loma Prieta, which was quite scary. I was in San Francisco at that time. You guys were here. Was everyone here?
Yeah.
So do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was quite intense. But I think in Tokyo, I mean, it's such a big city, and there's so many people, and the buildings are so big, and it's just, it's different. I sort of feel safer here, even though, you know, there are lots of quakes here, too. It's not as scary, and it was very scary. I was in a building near my yoga studio having lunch, and the building started to shake, and it was an old brick building, and people in Japan just looked up, because they're used to quakes, and they're very calm in quakes, so they're used to them, right? But it started just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, so people actually ran out of the building, which is really unusual. And we ran out to the street, and it was a 4-lane, right in Meguro, in front of the yoga studio that goes down towards the Amatadori in that street. It's a big four-lane street and with a lot of traffic, and everyone just slammed on the brakes, and then the street was like, it was like a wave underneath it. It was just, it was really intense, and there's that big, you know, in front of the station, that big skyscraper, there was a big building, and it was just going like this. And I just thought, I don't want to see that building fall, because I knew people in it, actually. And I just, and there was a woman next to me who was screaming. She was not Japanese. She was from the Philippines. The Japanese people were very calm. But this woman was screaming, and I just grabbed her and hugged her. And I thought, well, if this is my last moment on Earth, and somebody's, you know, I want to get a hug too, right? I don't know what was going through my mind, but I actually was, like, thinking I should take a movie of the skyscraper swaying, but I didn't have the presence of mind to do that. But I hugged this woman, and then it sort of calmed down, and then I thought of Yuto. I thought, I have to go get him. But I was right in front of my yoga studio. I knew there was a class, so I ran back in the studio to tell people to get out of that building, because they're really old, very unsafe building. And the guy, do we know them? Do we want them to come in? I ran in to get them, and they were in restorative yoga. And you know, people say restorative yoga is so relaxing. Have a seat. It's okay. Come on in. They said, "Oh no, we're okay." And I said, "No, I think you really need to leave the building, because it's just not a safe building." And so they finally did, and then another quake hit right when they were leaving. It was another big one. It was 6 minutes, the first one, and then there was another one, really big one after it. And then I started walking home, walking to the Yuto school to get him, and that's when we started getting reports of the tsunami coming in up north. And the sky changed, it started raining, and I was hitchhiking. Nobody picked me up, which is kind of unusual. I was hitchhiking, but I went to get Yuto at his school, since he was in kindergarten at that time. And the teacher stayed, and they stayed until the very last kid went home, because the parents had to, a lot of working parents had to come get the kids, and there was no trains, everything stopped, so it was hours. They were there till midnight, practically. But I found out that Shogo's father, who was 80 years old, had walked 2 miles to the school to come get Yuto. So I was very touched by that. He had walked and got him and taken him home. So we went home, and I couldn't get in touch with Shogo, but he came home on foot that night. It took him 8 hours to walk home. But everyone was safe, so yeah.
What happened to your yoga building? Did it come
down? It was torn down. It did not fall down, but
that
it was
day.
Torn down. It was not torn down that day. And it's actually a kind of interesting story. Maybe I should turn the recording off. I don't know if we need to record this part. But it was scheduled to be torn down. It had been scheduled for many years. And I've told Shogo, we need to find a new place. And he said, let's just wait, because if you wait, they'll buy us out. They'll pay us. And I said, well, we're just renters. They're not going to pay us. You know. And he said, no, let's just wait. And I thought, well, I was getting nervous. It's not that easy to find a rental of a business in Tokyo. But, you know, one thing I've learned about Shogo after 21 years of being married to the guy is he's usually right about everything, which is a bit annoying, but he's right about it in a very quiet kind of Shogo-like way. So I just thought, okay, I'm going to listen to this guy. And sure enough, I had the yoga studio for 10 years, and I was ready to close it. I thought, I've done what I need to do here, and now we have a child, and I want to be a mother. It's enough. And it turned out, and I didn't know this, Tokyo City government bought the building, and they gave us a lot of money to leave the place. Huh. Shogo was right, so they tore it down. Tokyo City government, you know, has a lot of money. So we got a lot of money, and I thought, okay, you know what? I have to open a new studio. Like, I can't. I felt like it was a gift to get that money into. I had to, because I said to my students, I think I'm going to close the studio. They said, you can't close the studio. It's not your studio. It's our studio. I was like, well, you guys run it then, right? You know, because I'm tired of running a studio. It's been 10 years. But then when I got this money, I thought, I need, whatever we're doing here needs to keep happening. So, and then I went up to Tohoku to volunteer, and I met those people, and we were able to do yoga with them, which was the one thing that, restorative yoga, they could, you know, relax because they're very traumatized. So that was my quick experience. And then just sitting down every day to write this book and thinking about what good can come out of this. It was intense, and it's very scary being there with the radiation, and a lot of people left, and I don't blame them for leaving at all. And I was surprised some people came back. if you were gone, I think, like, okay, you got out. Like, you know, you don't have to come back. Some people came back. But a lot of people are just there, and they're just living with it, and yeah. Any other questions? Comments?
You can assign books?
I hope so. If you guys buy them, I'll sign them. Yeah, because we don't want to take these home.
Boxes full of books.
Yeah, that's actually, you didn't have to bring those for something else. What a good sister, though. Thank you for, like, carrying them. Okay, well, thank you guys very
much.
Thank you.
And thank you for hosting me,
Many Rivers. Thank you on behalf of Many Rivers for being here. So, I haven't yet put it out, but I will shortly. We always have a donation bowl, and we encourage people to contribute to it. We share donations with our speakers, and we retain half to maintain this space, which is a nonprofit church corporation that owns and operates this space, in order to keep this sort of thing happening in future. So thank you all for coming tonight. Come back sometime when the shelves are back in their normal position. Come for our tea tasting tomorrow. And please, on your way out, check out all these awesome books over here to my right, your left. And Stuart is...
If you want to listen to more, there's a radio show tomorrow.
That's right.
Show.
Well, you say it, since you just started to say it.
So we'll be continuing this conversation on Cal's LP, that's 107.3 FM.
From 4 to 6 p.m.
Sebastopol, and it's online at www.kows.fm. You can, it streams, so you can listen to it at 4 to 6 p.m. Saturday.
Right, and that'll be on our website, mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, sometime thereafter.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank you so much for coming, you guys. Thank you for hosting me.